This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is for Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate, Bodhidharma and Peace of Mind, the main case. Master Bodhidharma sat in Zazen facing the wall. The second ancestor, who had been standing in the snow, cut off his arm and said, "Your disciple's mind is not yet at peace. I beg you, my teacher, please give it peace." Bodhidharma said, "Bring this mind to me and I'll set it at rest." The second ancestor said, "I've searched for the mind and it is finally unattainable." Bodhidharma said, "There, I have thoroughly set it at rest for you." Woman's commentary. The broken-toothed old foreigner proudly came over 100,000 miles across the sea. This was as if he were raising waves where there was no wind. Toward his end, Bodhidharma could enlighten only one disciple, but even he was crippled. San Lung does not even know four characters. In a poem, coming from the west and directly pointing, this great affair was caused by the transmission. The troublemaker who created a stir in Zen circles is, after all, you. So this morning we're completing an introductory retreat that was been going on all weekend. And I haven't given a talk on this koan in a long time, so I thought it was time to bring it back out. You know, in the teachings of Buddhism in all schools, there are stories and accounts of people and events. Karen Armstrong speaks of, in religious literature, of mythos and logos. That mythos are those stories that were never intended to be taken literally, but are offered as inspirational, guiding stories, pointing to certain principles that need to be brought out. And logos are those stories that are, or those teachings that are to be taken directly as they are. And so the fact that the Buddha was a human being is important because we know that he established that this is about human experience. It can be done by human beings like us. But there are many stories, and then there are stories that many people, perhaps particularly Westerners, would find hard to believe, and yet are taken as displays or accounts of highly developed spiritual beings who acquired different kinds of powers. But this is a good example, this koan, of this, I think. Bodhidharma is considered the founder of the Zen tradition, so he was an Indian master who is said to have gone to China and through his teachings have established the beginnings of what came to be the Zen tradition. Scholars have had difficulty finding definitive evidence about one person named Bodhidharma. There are different accounts of who he was or how he came into the records, and even what teachings are attributed to him. And then this specific story, this koan, is another example of how do we understand this? Because any story, regardless of whether we listen to it as though it's an actual historical account or whether it's something that is to be understood in a different way, we're still going to relate it to ourselves, right? If it's to have any power, if it's to have any value to us as a teaching story, right? We hear it and we sort of take it in and relate it to our own experience. And if we find resonance or find inspiration, then it's helpful. If we don't, then less so. And so this koan just presents a very sort of short piece of this whole dialogue It needs a little bit of explanation, like this cutting off the arm part. So in the transmission of the lamp account of Bodhidharma and Shen Kuang, who was his name before he became the second ancestor, Hueka, it said that he had been studying for a long time and had done a great deal of reading of the teachings of Confucius and Lao Tzu, but that he felt that he was still not getting to the depths, not only of his own understanding, but that what he was seeking, he was still not reaching. He was not finding what he was looking for. And so he heard about this great master Bodhidharma, who was sitting in a cave in Shaolin Monastery on the mountain. And so he thought, I'll go and ask him for the teachings. I'll go and ask to study with him. And so it says that he says, with this, this is his quote, with this supreme person so near, I should reach the deeper realms of understanding. And so he went to him, wanting to be instructed from morning till night. The master, however, Bodhidharma, would give him no instruction, but sat in meditation all the time facing the wall. So the scene is that Bodhidharma is sitting in meditation facing the wall. And so this is also, in the Zen tradition, part of the origin of our turning and facing the wall in our meditation, as well as understanding what does that mean to sit and face the wall. And Shen Kuang is standing outside asking for the teachings. Right? He's standing there presenting himself and asking to study. May I enter and study? And Bodhidharma ignores him. He doesn't turn around. He doesn't acknowledge him. And so Shen Kuang thinks to himself, people of old, all the old masters, sought the way by breaking up their bones, pulling out the marrow and opening up their veins to feed hungry animals, spreading hairs to cover the muddy road in order to let a great spiritual being pass through safely, or leaping off a cliff to feed a hungry tigress. And these are accounts in the Jataka tales of the previous lives of the Buddha when he was in previous births and lifetimes when he was developing himself, and sometimes as animals, sometimes as a human being, and had all of these different experiences where basically he was offering himself in different ways as a bodhisattva on the bodhisattva path to further develop his own spirituality until he came to the point where he was born as the Buddha. And so Shen Kuang is recounting in his memory all of these examples before him and thinking, if they were willing to do this, then who am I? You know, then how difficult is this for me to stand out here and wait until the time is right? And so and so it says on that, it was December of the year, and so it snowed heavily during the night, and Shen Kuang stood firmly without moving as the snow fell deeper and deeper and came up above his knees in the cold. And so clearly what this is showing us is of the search of what is a spiritual journey. I mean, why is this story important? Because this is a really central story in the Zen tradition. Why is this story important? And so Shen Kuang is going to study. So his path has already begun, but he's not satisfied. So he's seeking the teachings. So he's seeking out the true Dharma. He knows that he needs to study. He wants to study with Bodhidharma. He's asking for the teachings. And he's not yet being met. Why? So first, there has to be true Dharma. There has to be a teaching that is true, that is actually in accord with reality, with the nature of things. And then there has to be true practice. So upaya, skillful means, is how does an enlightened being bring the Dharma, enlighten the mind of a student? And so we talk about skillful means, but a teacher, like a physician, can have medicine that will save your life. But if the patient won't take the medicine, it's not medicine. If the student doesn't receive the teachings, can't receive the teachings, then it's not skillful means. Or the student isn't yet ready. And so how do we develop ourselves, in a sense, prepare ourselves to both seek and then receive? This is a very important thing. It's a very real thing. You know, in our culture, we're used to, you know, if you go in, you put the right amount of money down, you get what you're looking for, right? And we consider that in sort of an even trade. That's my part of the bargain. This is not like that. And in this story, and there are many teachings that present an example of a great aspiration, of someone who is expressing great aspiration in an embodied form, or presenting a fully realized life, how a fully enlightened being lives their life. And the purpose of that, of course, is to show us that possibility, right? So we can aspire to that. The danger of that is that we look at that and then we look back at ourselves and we think, oh my, right? And so rather than see it and use it as aspiration, we see it to confirm what may already be there, which is a sense of self-doubt, of self-insufficiency. So rather than urging us on, it actually is discouraging. And that's not how it's intended. And so you're standing in the snow, asking and not yet receiving. Or is he receiving what he has not yet expected to receive? What is he receiving? By Bodhidharma's not turning and responding. So from the very first step, as we set out, before we even know we've stepped out, before we may even know that we have begun a search or begun a path, when looking back, we will see it's not like other paths. This relationship that he was trying to establish with his teacher is not like other relationships. This conversation, this dialogue is not going to be like other dialogues. And what happens at every step along the way is there is a turning of the mind, a turning. Because when we expect to meet something familiar and we meet something unfamiliar, we might turn away and go look for that familiar thing, or we might pause and the mind turns slightly, becomes tuned slightly towards that very thing. He's seeking. He's sincere, clearly. And when we seek, particularly when we're sincere, we expect that to be met. We expect this person to be acknowledged. We expect the purpose of our journey to be recognized as sincere. When we give something, we expect something in return. Well, the teacher's vow is to offer the Dharma. Always. What is Bodhidharma offering? But in that offering, it's not like a spoken or unspoken contract. If I do this, I get this. And so where does that leave Shenkuang? So the work of the koan is you become this person. Right? It's not an imaginary thing. It's not a fantasizing thing. You let go of the self and enter into this very time, this very moment, this standing in the snow, facing your teacher, asking for the teachings, and seeing only the teacher's back. Where does that leave you in that moment? So Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. Shenkuang was also facing the wall. How true was his searching, his desire? How deep was his faith? What were his options right? This might be a time when you start considering your options, right? What are my alternatives here? And if you have alternatives, then you're already in trouble. I remember more than once sitting in this zendo, feeling helpless, hopeless, despairing, facing the wall of my own mind that would not yield, that would not turn and face me, that would not give me what I wanted. And thinking, okay, what are my options? Because this doesn't seem to be working out. And realizing I don't have any options, actually. Right? For me, I really deeply felt that there were no options, that this was the only thing that I had encountered that I had such trust in and faith in, and had explored other things where I did not find that. And I just knew in my bones that this is it. You're either going to make this work, you have to find a way in. Period. You have to find a way in. And the liberation of that, I can't overstate. Because then there was only one thing to do, which is to turn back in. This way of entering was also understood at his time, right? This is a practice that continued in various ways, different traditions. And so in our time, this would not be understood. Right? And so Dada Roshi established the barrier gates. And these are gates of entry for people who want to enter into formal training as a student. And just like Bodhidharma, not meant to discourage and to send you away, but actually to bring the person in closer. Closer with their eyes open. To turn the mind. And so finally, after standing all night, Bodhidharma turns and says, what are you seeking standing there in the snow all of this time? And Xianquan begins to cry and says, please, please have mercy. Open the gate of nectar. Deliver the message that liberates all sentient beings. So with his heart broken open, he utters this cry. Give me the teaching that liberates sentient beings. And Bodhidharma says, the supreme unequaled spiritual way of the Buddhas is accessible only after vast eons of striving to overcome the impossible and to bear the unbearable. How could a person of such small virtue, such little wisdom and slight interest, and with such a slow mind attain the true vehicle? Striving for it would just be a vain effort. Now what is he offering? Before entering the monastery gate, before hearing the Dharma, before you even know that you're seeking, what are you seeking? Why is that important to understand? Why does that need to be clarified? Because it will be challenged. Because whatever we think it is, whatever we think we are, whatever we think this life is, whatever we think practice is, whatever we think is going to happen next, is going to be challenged. And not in the way that we think. Even if it has been told to you directly, this is what's going to happen, when it happens, that's not what's happening. Not for you. So many times I listen to my teacher talk about such things, and I thought, yes, I'm ready for that. And then when it happened, I wasn't ready for that. And I didn't remember, oh, this is what my teacher was talking about. No. What was happening was wrong. What was happening was difficult. What was happening was bad. Maybe it had to do with me. It's interesting how none of the teachings are secret, and yet when they arrive, how secret they are. And so again, it's turning the mind turning the mind. And so Bodhidharma seems not to be moved by this display of emotion. Please offer the teachings that liberates all sentient beings. Why? And so Hueka, or Shenkuang still, Hueka was the name Bodhidharma gave to him after. To show his sincerity, he takes out a knife and he cuts off his arm. Right? So this is the part where you don't, kids, don't do this at home. So what is that? And this is appears not only in other Buddhist accounts, but also in other traditions of supreme sacrifice. Right? But even though he cut off his arm, his suffering remains, his attachments remain, his sense of self remain. They're not in the arm. In a sense, cutting off the arm is sort of the easy part. What about his distractedness? What about his self-importance? What about his self-pity, his impatience, his procrastination? What about our attachment to being distant? What about our attachment to our suffering? What am I willing to let go of? What do I preserve? How much unhappiness am I willing to accommodate? How much suffering that I inflict on others am I willing to accommodate? In other words, what am I asking for? What am I asking of myself? What is this life? And so this arm actually has to be cut off over and over and over and over, thousands of times, millions of times. And you'll be surprised at how often it just grows right back. Or seems to. But actually, it gets a little bit easier each time. I was thinking of Kubler-Ross's stage of dying. You know, so first we enter in and it's denial, which is like, this won't take long. Right? Or, it's not me. And then there's anger. Why is this taking so long? Then there's bargaining. Okay, I'll give you one, but I keep two. Or I'll give you two, but I keep one. And then depression. I'm hopeless. I'm helpless. I'm not a Buddha. It is me, after all. And then acceptance. Moment to moment, nonstop flow. And so Bodhidharma sees him cutting off his arm. And he realizes, it says, that he was a good vessel for the Dharma. And he says, all Buddhas in search of the way have begun by letting go of their attachment to their bodies for the sake of the Dharma. Now you have cut off your arm in front of me. You may have the right disposition. And so then he gives him a spiritual name, Hueka. And Hueka says, may I hear about the Dharma seal of the Buddha. So now he's entering in. One step. He's not yet fully in, but he's taking one step. May I hear about the Dharma seal of the Buddha? And Bodhidharma says, the Dharma seal is not something which can be heard about from others. So Hueka has expressed his desire for the teaching that liberates all beings. He wants to hear the teaching, which can be heard from a master. Bodhidharma is facing the person in front of him. And he's waiting for the person in front of him to face himself. And so Hueka says, please, my mind is not yet at peace. I beg you to set it at rest for me. Finally. The student is ready. The teacher appears. I was thinking of a poem that I was reading recently by Patty Ann Rogers. And she says, how far down does the yellow of the sunflower descend? By intention, by mayhem, or godsend, how deep do the reverberations of that glowing yellow go? Through stem and viney roots, into the night of the loamy soil, into the buried crystal of yesterday's rain, and then rising back up and out again into pollen and petal, and up deep into the fiery blue-orange sky of the sun's yellow summer eye, I wonder about this. How far down does the yellow go? How far down does the searching go? How far down does the desire for peace go? How far down does our commitment to liberation, to compassion, to being a benefit in this world go? And how do we hear this? How do you hear this? Right? So Hwiko was a monk, had left home. So you might imagine this, standing in the cave, seeking Bodhidharma's teaching in your home, and then suddenly there's a voice. Dad, can you help me with your homework, my homework? Honey, I need your help out here, just as you were ready to cut off your arm. And this is not a small thing. In fact, this may be one of the biggest things, is how do you hold the question of life and death, which is a vital matter, and is not an idea, but is something that is felt deep in the marrow, that goes down into the dark night of the loamy soil and up into the bright orange sky. How do you hold that, as Master Dawei says, on the tip of your nose so you don't forget? Because when we forget, then we forget, we begin to forget what's important, practice begins to fade away. But how do you hold that, right, in the context of everything? I mean, such an important part of coming together, of having this time, of having this place to practice together, practicing intensively, is to free ourselves of all of those concerns that take our attention outward, not because they're at odds with the Dharma, or not but because they inherently will cool that spiritual fire, but because we have to develop the capacity to experience them as one world, as one path. And we've got much, much more experience and conditioning in seeing, experiencing that part of our lives as the other part of our life. So, my mind is not yet at peace. Please set it at rest for me. Master Dogen, in the fascicle we're studying, speaks about everyday mind. But we can change that to say Bodhi mind, the mind that is not yet at peace, that seeks peace. Bodhi mind, Dogen says, opens the gate of the inner chamber. And because thousands of gates and myriads of doors open and close all at once, this is Bodhi mind. It is beyond words, and yet we must practice expressing it, because then it becomes clear. It's beyond knowing, and yet it's important to try and understand the teachings so that we can practice in a way that's true. It's like our intellect, our understanding, our expressions, our guides. So it's like they come along with us, they lead us at different moments along the way, and then there's a point as you're walking along this path in moments where they stop, that guide stops and says, now you must go on alone. I can't go with you here. Because from here on, the next step you take is not my realm, is not the realm of words and understanding. You can't take me with you. I can't guide you there. That's why you're sitting on a diamond seat. In this seeking, thousands of gates and myriads of doors open and close all at once. In that moment, my mind is not yet at peace. Please set it at peace for me. It's like the whole universe is present. The whole universe. Everything in that moment has suddenly stepped forward and become available. And yet, as Woman says in the commentary, it's like raising waves with no wind. Right? That from the beginning, the peace that Wicca was looking for is not in the cave. It's not in Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma can't give it to him. It certainly isn't in the cutting off of the arm. And yet each step for that person was essential to getting to the point of discovering, oh, from the beginning, it was my nature. From the beginning, it was never a hair apart. That's why this collection of koans is called the Gateless Gate. It appears as a gate. Its reality is it's gateless. It can't keep you out. And so he says, my mind is not at peace. My mind is unsettled. My heart is broken. My heart is cold. My body is restless. My body is ill at ease. All of these aspects of our being, where are they all? This mind, this heart, this body, this dis-ease, this brokenness, this desperation, this sorrow, where is it? And so Bodhidharma says, bring it to me, and I will set it at rest for you. And we can interpret that at a distance on the basis of our story, right? Why is my mind not at peace? Well, it's because things didn't work out the way I wanted, or it's your fault. Or that'll change when I get that raise, or I start in a relationship. But it doesn't. That just is like a finish line that just keeps receding into the distance. In the commentary, he says there's a wonderful metaphor by an old master who said, to try and find a person on an uninhabited island will prove fruitless. You're looking for someone, but there's nobody there. Once, however, you realize no one's there, then the island becomes yours. He says, that's international law. It's the universal law effective throughout the ages. Now that whole universe of that island is your universe. But that only happens in the moment when you realize no one is there. And so in the account, Hweka says, I've searched for it, but in the end it is unattainable. But it doesn't say what happened between Bodhidharma's request, bring your mind to me, and when Hweka comes back and says, I have searched and searched and searched. Many students will say, in working on this koan, the mind can't be found. No, they still have it. The mind that is not yet at peace is still there. It's not in the words. And so the nature of the koan is that it's not that you have to take on Hweka's state of mind. How could you? It's that the koan invites you into that in yourself. Until you get to the point where all of your guides have left and you are alone and not even the self can be found. I have searched and I have searched and I cannot find it. Hweka wasn't thinking that this was going to be a dialogue that would be taken up by Zen students in the future. He wasn't thinking it would end up in a book. He wasn't thinking anyone is listening to this. He wasn't listening to this. He wasn't standing apart. And to be able to enter into that space means we have to be able to enter into that within ourselves, which is no small thing. So in that moment, the whole of his life depended upon it. And so sometimes we're encouraged by the words, practice as though your life depends upon it. Because there's a point, if we look carefully, we realize that's true. It's true now. It's true unavoidably, whether we acknowledge it or not. What our life is depends on just this. And that's true whether we're practicing or not, whether we're practicing Buddhism or not. It's not a Buddhist thing. It's a human thing. What is this mind that is not yet at peace? If you say it doesn't exist, then you're denying the reality. If you say it exists, then Bodhidharma says, bring it to me and I'll set it at rest for you. So where is this mind? Is it in your head? Is it in your heart? Is it somewhere in your body? Is it small or large? We know the dis-ease. We know the not yet at peace. It's undeniable, but where is it? I've searched. It cannot be found. Your mind has been set at peace. This koan brings the student to the point where there's nowhere to step forward, there's no way to step back. At that point, there's just leaping. At that moment, when Bodhidharma said, your mind is set at peace, that was the moment where suddenly Huika realized it cannot be found. And that cannot be explained. That's not in the words that I just said. Now, this is an expression of a very deep searching, a very profound moment of a path. And so for everyone listening to this, anyone who comes across this, of course, anyone who's drawn to this, and of course there would be many who wouldn't, this just wouldn't resonate. What's the problem? But for anyone for whom it resonates, then the question is, how do I hear this? How do I use this? How do I put this to work within this life? And not just within this life, but within this place where I am in my own journey, which may be at the very beginning. Right? I may not know if this is my path. I may not know what am I willing to let go of. I may not know really what that means yet. That's always going to be the case. And so we hear it from where we are. And then if we continue on that journey, we hear it again, and now we hear it differently. And then we hear it differently. And then we hear it differently. And at each step along the way, if we're hearing it, it comes closer. The mind is turning. When Xinguang uttered those words, they weren't words on a page. They weren't spoken for our benefit. It was his own life and death. It was very personal. Coming from the West and directly pointing, this great affair was caused by the transmission. So in the Buddha's enlightenment, he was faced with this tremendous situation. He had realized this profound enlightenment, this great liberation, and that liberation was that every single one of us has the very thing we're seeking, is the very thing we're seeking. That to begin, take a single step is to begin to walk away. And yet, if we don't take that step, then how can we discover that? And so how to teach and how to guide students along a path in which for some time they think they're moving towards something, peace, liberation, enlightenment, compassion, and moving away from something, sadness, sorrow, attachment, suffering. But that in actual fact, all along the way, they are not taking a single step. How to teach and offer practices so that that's what's actually happening. So that's what we have. That's what this is. Kind of wonderful. The troublemaker who created such a stir, the wind that is raising the waves. Right? Because as soon as we've been talking about suffering, it becomes more solidified. But if we don't talk about it, we don't acknowledge it, then it can stay hidden until it's too late. And so it's understood that to do all of this, in a sense, creates all these waves, but so that we can see more clearly, so that we can turn towards. And then he says, the troublemaker who created such a stir is after all you. That within all of the slings and arrows of our misfortune, within all of the difficult things in our world, the inequities, the injustices, all of the things that we need to be addressing as human beings and as practitioners, that ultimately, and at every step along the way, the mind that is not at peace is yours, is mine. And so we turn the light around. This life, it doesn't come again. This way is never a step apart. Spring morning, gently falling rain, finally free of yesterday and tomorrow, each and every breath opens the gate of the mind crowned. So I encourage each of us, and I mean each of us, those of us who have been practicing for years and years, those who are just beginning, to whatever the path is, to maintain and keep alive that inquiry. Dogen says it's like holding an infant in your arms, like a baby Buddha. That it has all the power, all the capacity of life, untethered, unhindered, shining, compassionate, but it has to be nourished because it's just a little baby. It's fragile, it's vulnerable. And in the beginning, it is very much like that. So we have to tend to it, like a garden. And then it becomes stronger, more resilient. Not that it can be ignored, but it's easier. But it always has to be continually nourished. And so whatever that is, however that is, please take care of that baby.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.